But design research really gets at understanding the people and saying, we don't know exactly what we think the solution is here. We're going to go listen to the people who are really experiencing it and have empathy with those people and their situations.
Hi, this is Ike Evans of the Hogg Foundation for Mental Health, and you're listening to Into the Fold, Issues in Mental Health. The Hogg Foundation is a strategic grant maker based at the University of Texas at Austin. To learn more, visit us at hogg.utexas.edu. When most folks hear the word design, what comes to mind are discrete objects that serve a practical purpose, a building, an app, a consumer product. So what the heck does the term design in health mean? And is it really possible to design a mental health system? Does it even make sense to talk that way? And how is design-oriented thinking being incorporated into the realm of mental health? Here to help shed some light on these questions is Kat Jones, who is with the University of Texas at Austin's Dell Medical School. Kat was trained as a medical illustrator and is now Director of Strategy and Mission for the Design Institute for Health. Kat, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
It's not that uncommon anymore to hear people talking about bringing design thinking to complex problems, but it's still a hard concept to grasp unless you've done it, I'm sure. In a nutshell, what are the hallmarks of a design approach to a problem?
It's a great question and a question that we get asked frequently. First of all, I think the simplest thing is to say, I think people always think about design as how it looks, but we like to talk about the fact that design is also how it works. And from that standpoint, design can do much more than just how something looks or feels. It certainly impacts those, but it can do things like simplifying complex problems, you know, reducing friction within a system, improving experiences for people, creating truly engaging experiences. So some of the things that we bring to that are processes that are well-defined that can help really understand the underlying human needs and then really take a set of processes that bring an iterative approach to creating new solutions that help really redesign or manipulate the what surrounds us and how we can think about that differently. In terms of the specific hallmarks of a design approach to a problem, I think two of the things you'll consistently see are empathy in the way that design research is done. And then in terms of the process, it's a very iterative approach that involves a lot of prototyping. So design research is something that is really a different approach than you've seen, especially in a lot of healthcare or a lot of academic settings where you traditionally see, you know, lots and lots of multi-year long research and white papers with lots of quantitative data. But design research really gets at understanding the people and saying, we don't know exactly what we think the solution is here. We're going to go listen to the people who are really experiencing it and have empathy with those people and their situations. Similarly, prototyping and taking an iterative approach are common to design and how it solves problems. Again, I think most systems are not used to just saying, how can we have kind of a rapid, low-cost, low-investment way of testing out a solution, learning from it, iterating on it before we go forward with the big investment in something new and different that may or may not work. So those are a couple of the hallmarks, I would say, that are consistent about taking a design approach to solving really complex systemic problems.
Yeah, you know, taking in a more systems-level point of view, that people, all people, are daunted by the complexity, the sheer complexity of mental health. I wonder how design thinking can help us make community and systems level change. What do you think?
Well, I agree with everything you just said. And I would say in some of the design work that we're doing in the space of mental health, you're right. There are a lot of people to go take an empathic viewpoint with about how they're experiencing the system. I mean, that's one of the complexities in and of itself. This isn't just a medical challenge. It really does cross into a lot of social sectors. It crosses into law enforcement. It crosses into justice. It crosses into education systems. You know, it's not just a brain disease and a medical malady. It really does cross over into every single part of people's lives. And a lot of people experience it. So the first thing is, even the design research has to interview a wider set of people experiencing the system. So certainly people living with mental health conditions and their families and loved ones and caregivers, but also providers across all parts of the system, inpatient, outpatient, in communities, all of that. But then also, like I said, law enforcement, judicial systems, looking at school systems, you know, looking at really this is all parts of people's lives. So a design intervention would say we can't, you know, even if the design problem was for a specific clinic or a hospital, it wouldn't solve the problem to only look at an intervention there. It actually has to be an intervention that is both social and medical. So that's one of the ways I think design can go and say, how are we going to address this complexity? So what happens is when we go and actually conduct design research and go in context into people's lives and observe how they're experiencing the system, we pay attention to what we're seeing. And when we come back and bring back all those insights from all those different people experiencing different parts of the system different ways, we start to actually see patterns. So even some of the things that might be difficult for a sheriff might be just as difficult for, you know, a person who is living with a mental health condition. And you wouldn't expect that at the beginning. But once you start to find those patterns, things like that there's so much stigma and fear and misunderstanding around these conditions from people living with them all the way to everyone they experience throughout the day and other people experiencing the system. Once you get to some of those commonalities, then you're actually designing for the same thing across the complexity of the system. Those are problems that have to be solved across the whole thing.
And I would imagine you think that getting at those underlying human needs is one of the main things that a design approach can help us toward. The kind of observations that a designer might make of how it is that people do and experience things, how do they differ from all the other kinds of poking and prodding and research of these populations that's already happening, you know?
Right. Well, I would say, first of all, design research, there's a lot of different methods involved in it, but it's very much about going into the context of people's lives. So we go to them. We like to go to people's homes, go to people's, for this projects in this realm, we've gone to jails, we've sat in mental health court, we have, you know, gone and observed different psychiatric hospitals, you know, for example, all different, you know, nonprofits and how they do their work. So we go in context and we observe and we listen.
Would you say that it is more experiential?
Yeah.
Okay.
So we go in context and it's much more experiential. A lot of times the things we pick up on when we're doing design research in that way, in the context of someone's life, we pick up not only what they tell us through their words, but what they tell us through their actions or through subtle things that, you know, they may not realize they're telling us. They can show us things and we learn things from using all our senses. So it's not just, that's really how it differs, especially from something like quantitative research, which it's great to couple both of these together. But we learn very different things about why people do things, what their workarounds are, what problems they're actually solving because the system hasn't solved those and how they're doing it. That helps us know what problem we're actually solving and it gives us ideas about good ways to solve it.
For mental health, what opportunities are missed when we choose not to approach it with the lens of design thinking?
Well, building on some of what we were just talking about, I think a lot of times one of the things that design thinking often does and that we find, not in every project, but often, is that we end up reframing the assignment. So a lot of times someone might come to us and say, we need you to redesign X, Y, or Z. Maybe it's we think we need to redesign a hospital. But actually, when we get into it, we realize it's a larger process, or we have to reframe and say, well, a hospital is only one part of a system that actually needs to be part of a continuum. So we need to think about this a little bit differently. How might we design a hospital that's part of a continuum of mental health rather than just thinking about the inpatient acute care? So a lot of times design will reframe the question so that we get to a better answer. I also think, what happens a lot is that people are all doing great work in this space. People are working very hard. They care a lot. But it's rare for people to step outside and get off the grid of their daily life and their daily work to actually observe how is this impacting people who are experiencing the system, and to see what's working and what's not. And I think that's a big part of what we do with design thinking, is that we come in and ask people to stop and step off the grid and look at it from a different perspective. And what we find is sometimes reframing it, posing a different question, allows people to open up new ideas to solve problems they've been trying to solve for a long time, but they just never thought about solving it that way. And that's a really nice way of changing the conversation and moving things forward and bringing out new innovative ideas about how to solve problems.
Kat, I'd love to hear about your involvement with LiveStrong, because it is something that you've mentioned. Why don't you tell us more about that and what the major takeaways for you were from it?
So LiveStrong was a brand that I developed and a movement I was part of helping create in my previous role. And It has a lot of parallels, actually, to work in mental health. LiveStrong, first of all, was addressing cancer survivors, which is an incredibly huge group of people. It's a very pervasive issue. And like mental health, it touches everyone. Some of the things that I think are common about working in mental health and the work we did on LiveStrong, first of all, reframing the assignment. The original assignment for LiveStrong was actually to create a website that provided new resources through a website online for cancer survivors. The Lance Armstrong Foundation, as they were called at that point in time, realized more people were surviving the treatments, and there wasn't a lot of information about what comes after that. So that was the original goal. But as we did our design research, we found that really there was a fair amount of information in the medical realm, but not so much in the emotional realm, and even less in the practical realm. And as we dug into those and said, well, what would you want in those realms? We started to learn things like the best resources were actually other people who had lived through the same thing. And so it wasn't about getting to the best expert at X, Y, and Z Cancer Center. It was about, how do we find each other? How do we connect with each other? How do we share stories with each other? How do we support each other through living beyond cancer? We also learned that the language needed to be more empowering. There were a lot of people who the word survivor wasn't powerful enough to inspire them. And so they wanted new language. And that's some of where the language around Living Strong came from, which wasn't something that was really out there at that point in time. Everything was pretty soft and pastel and easy in the cancer space. So there's some parallels around understanding what people need, where they want to get it from. And that reframed it from saying it's not just this online resource. It's got to be a movement and a way for people to find each other who can share stories. And so what we ended up doing was creating a community of people and really developing new language, new conversations they could have, not just about the types of treatments they had survived, but also about how they're living with it, how they're talking to their kids about it, how they're dealing with insurance, all those practical parts of life. And so all of those apply here in mental health as well.
You can get some ways into working on a problem before you realize that you're not really having the right discussion. And what it sounds like you're saying is that a design approach offers some tried and true methods for getting us to that point of epiphany a little bit faster.
That's right. That's right. And I think also the sooner you reframe the question, the more it opens up ideas from people. I mean, it's just so exciting to see this happen when you reframe the question. In design, we have a phrase that we all always use called, how might we? And a lot of times we get to the point where we say, what are our how might we questions? And when you get to the point of saying, oh, this is actually the problem we need to solve, and then you offer back to the team you're working with, how might we, you know, solve this problem? And all of a sudden, just all different kinds of ideas start flowing. And so sometimes just that simple reframing, it goes a long ways in actually creating innovation.
Any other examples out there? I mean, where else has design thinking helped to, you know, transform the health and human services space?
Oh, there's so many. I think, you know, one of my favorite examples that I think people wouldn't necessarily expect to be a design at the heart of this is one that a number of my colleagues at the Design Institute worked on. In their previous role at IDEO, a large kind of world-renowned design firm. And it's another really large, systemically complex challenge that impacts society, which is changing the design of the health insurance exchange. And so one of the pieces of design that IDEO led was how to design those health insurance exchanges when the Affordable Care Act came out and, you know, people were going to be making these insurance choices in a really new and different way. And it would have been one thing to just say, okay, we're going to make this online tool and we're going to do it this way. But, you know, the government isn't known for necessarily creating the most well-designed online experiences. So part of what happened was a number of foundations came together and hired this group to say, let's create the best template that all the states and eventually the federal government can follow to create, you know, online experiences that will actually allow people to feel good about how they do this. And so part of that was in the design research of that project involved really understanding, you know, from an empathy standpoint, how daunting it was going to be for people who weren't necessarily educated and knowing how to make health insurance choices. This isn't what most people spend their time thinking about, but they were going to have to come down to make this very practical decision on their own using an online tool. And so, you know, a lot of it had to do with recognizing that and then looking at how to really shepherd someone through it. So IDEO basically did all that design research, created these templates, and then most of the states who rolled out those exchanges based their systems on this template created by design research. And then eventually the federal exchange followed it as well when it had some trouble at the beginning. So that's an example of a way that I don't think everyone, and that's fine. Actually, when design works really well, you don't even know it's there. You know, so I think that's an example that people wouldn't necessarily anticipate about how it changed the way that new health and human service worked and understood what people were going to need to make it a usable, comfortable online experience for them to make a very important decision. One other example I was thinking about that's more recent and more tangible through our work here as part of Dell Medical School is that we've recently launched our new clinics last fall, not quite a year ago now, called UT Health Austin. And the Design Institute was very involved in looking at not only some of the physical space design, but also the experience design of how those clinics might happen. Some of the things that were going to be very different about those clinics is that they were going to be person-centered, and they were also going to be value-based care, which is, you know, new language around saying, right now, the entire model of care is driven by a fee-for-service model, and that really informs the way a lot of the transactions drive the experiences and the whole way it's set up. Value-based care is around how do we create outcomes where people actually get better, and we are paid based on whether they actually get better instead of just how many things we do to and for these people to try to understand what's going on, whether they get better or not. So in designing that, one of the things that we advocated for was not having a waiting room, which in and of itself is not necessarily a new idea. It's been done before. The thing that was really different here was, you know, not having a waiting room isn't even so much about not having a waiting room as it is about how many shifts it makes in the entire experience of a clinic and how it shifts things to value-based care and person-centered care. So what we found was when you remove the waiting room, you actually have to solve a cascade of other operational problems that actually improve the patient experience. It's not just about the fact that people get to the clinics and self-room, but even the fact that when they get there, they get kind of the equivalent of a boarding pass, and they go to their room and they don't have to wait. They go right to the room. But even that act starts to automatically trigger a different experience for people, and it starts to let the people know that they are going to have a role in this, which is one of the design principles we were aiming to change, which is reducing the hierarchy and giving people more of a role in their care, which is one of the concepts of value-based care. So, removing the waiting room also does things like the operations of the care team to really understand where are all the patients and how do we get to them and how are we, it just causes a whole cascade. It changes everything about the electronic health records. You know, right now, electronic health records are not designed to see, value-based care with multiple providers seeing the patient in one visit, or, how do you include things like patient-reported outcomes or shared decision-making in those tools? So, it really becomes something that triggers a number of other operational changes and design changes that improve patient experience.
Well, man, I'm suddenly wanting to ask you if there are just things that you've ever noticed while being in a waiting room yourself. At least, is there any way that this could be done differently?
Oh, yeah. It's funny. The one thing we joke about at the Design Institute is we all have many, many opinions. We've actually done polls amongst our group of what we dislike most about waiting rooms, whether it's the terrible magazines that transmit lots of germs, whether it's the really bad, loud TV show that's on, whether it's the fake plants, the poor lighting, the lack of privacy when you're trying to talk about personal things, the amount of time you sit there. I mean, just there's a number of things that are not well designed in waiting rooms. I think one of the things that would be better that we've incorporated somewhat into the UT Health Austin is that we have really thought about the fact that, first of all, because we don't have a designated waiting room, we get quite a bit of real estate back. So you can actually create things like, larger patient rooms, but even we have some lounges and cafe. If you have a family member or someone or a caregiver who came with you and they don't want to come with you into the actual appointment, there's some really nice places where they can go and be productive and do work. Think about how people go and work at coffee shops now and like to do that. And so we have various sort of lounge spaces set up and things like that. I think things like that would be a much better use of what could have been, a waiting room.
Yeah, it's one of those, I feel this way, but that's a rant for another day kind of experience.
Yeah.
When you happen to endure long lines at the bank.
It's not just that Stacey Chang, who's our executive director, often says it's not just that people don't want a waiting room, they don't need a waiting room. If you actually design the system to operate well, you don't need a waiting room. A waiting room is often a place from the fee-for-service model where if you think about it in the terms of, you're basically like warehousing, the next person that you need to come in. And
the visit itself is so damn short a lot of times. It's like, can we at least, spend an additional 45 minutes just talking about whatever, because that's how long I was in your darn waiting room or something like that,
Right. Well, and one of the things we do with a value-based care model is we use care teams where you're seen by all the providers while you're there. So they come to you. So you go to your room and multiple providers will come and see you while you're there. So the appointment's much longer. I mean, our appointments may range from half an hour to an hour and a half, depending on how many people are going to see you. It's rather than a patient going to five or six different appointments, they come in, they're in their comfortable room that's larger because there's no waiting room, and the providers rotate around and come to them.
While we're talking about examples, we should mention that right now, Austin State Hospital, or ASH, is undergoing a major redesign that you are a part of. And we're not just talking about an architectural renovation either. Can you say a little bit about who was involved in this project and what your role is in particular from a design standpoint?
Sure. This is a fantastic project that I've been honored to be part of. Texas legislature in the last session identified several parts of the state hospital system that needed to be rebuilt or renovated and allocated funding to that end, recognizing the need for these services and for focus on mental health, which we're grateful for. Health and Human Services Commission is leading all of the state hospital redesign work, including the Austin State Hospital project. And so they have contracted with Dell Medical School to lead that redesign effort. Steve Strakowski, who's our chair of psychiatry, is really the leader of the project, and he's convened a very diverse group in its steering committee for this project. He knew from the get-go that it would need to involve a wide cross-section of perspectives and leaders across mental health. So there are, aside from academic and medical schools being involved, there's local mental health authorities, there are nonprofits, there are people with lived experience, there are components, there's sheriffs, law enforcement, judicial system. He also brought in the Design Institute, the group that I work with, because he knew that we could bring the design process that we've been talking about to look at this very complex, challenging problem that's been around for a long time. The other big difference also about this state hospital redesign is that the Austin State Hospital is not just looking at the facility that needs to be replaced and redesigned, but saying, look, if we are going to spend all this money to build a new hospital, we should really look at the entire system and say, what do we need to redesign around the whole system, and what hospital might we design based on those needs? We're not just saying, what would the most modern hospital look like, but how might we really think about this opportunity to design a new psychiatric hospital in the context of the larger continuum of what's needed across the entire system?
There's certainly a lot of excitement around that project here in Austin and beyond, because, you know, the ash catchment area is a lot larger than I think a lot of people imagine. So what comes after design thinking? I mean, what must happen either alongside or following a redesign process, like ash, for example, to ensure that the new system supports our community in the way that the committee intends?
It's a great question. And first of all, this work will take a long time. It will, you know, it will go, it will, even though we're our current, you know, project, our next big deadline is to take our report and our recommendations back to the next legislative session. This will go on, you know, for many, many years. So this is first of all, a very long-term project, but alongside of it, I mean, part of what's happening is, we're taking the opportunity of getting a chance to rebuild a facility and to look at what the entire system could do. So when you think about that, that means it's going to have all kinds of new components, and all the subcommittees that are part of this kind of reflect that. It's going to need, like, for example, I specifically am heading up, in addition to some of the service design redesign work, I'm also heading up some of the communications work. And this is a space where clearly there's going to be some new language around and building awareness and reducing stigma. So there's just so much we could talk about there, but it's also going to need things like, there will need to be policy changes. There's, you know, we're looking at financial models and smarter ways to take taxpayer dollars and use them to provide, you know, the right care at the right place at the right time. And so what does that really look like? We're looking at operational models. We're looking at collaborations. We're looking at all kinds of, you know, different pieces. So alongside of what the original assignment was, which was this facility, there's all kinds of other work that needs to be done to really build out the vision for what a you know, how Texas could now actually be established as a leader in creating, you know, the best brain health system that exists in the country.
It is not uncommon for people who know a lot about something to be a little bit cocky when it comes to its broad applicability to a whole range of problems. And people fitting this description write books. So if your thing is management, how management can fix the world, how management can save your marriage, political campaigns are a metaphor for life, that kind of thing. So this is my way of asking, what can design thinking not do for us, or is not a substitute for?
Well, I think design thinking, I don't know, think about that for a minute. I mean, to me, design thinking brings a framework that allows you to solve very complex problems. I think one of the things that's inherent in it is not knowing the answer before you start.
Right.
One of the things it's not going to do is, you know, just prove out a hypothesis that may or may not be right. It's right. going to, it's also not going to allow you to operate in isolation. I think one of the things that design thinking does that's very hard for human beings, and especially large systemic challenges that involve many sectors having to work together that usually don't work together, is that you must come together. It's the, all of us aren't as smart as, no, sorry, I messed that up. It's none of us is as smart as all of
right.
us. Yeah. And, you know, that approach is not something, you know, when people want to solve a problem, a lot of times they want to say, I know the answer, let's do it this way. And that's usually not the best way to do it. So design thinking is not going to allow people to act in a solo nature. It's not going to allow them to move forward with an idea that they think is right, that may not be right. It's going to convene a large group of people. It's going to test out ideas. It's going to improve on them. It's going to learn as we go. It is not going to perpetuate some of the very stuck problems that we have today.
In preparation for this episode, I read the following about how the Design Institute came to be. And I quote, it was established because health is one of the last frontiers to embrace design as a creative, human-centered approach to designing, defining, rather, and solving problems. It's been a great conversation, and I think that that's a great point to end on. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That does it for this episode. As always, visit us at howg.utexas.edu. Check out the HOG blog for more stories about transforming how communities promote mental health in everyday life. This isn't our first episode featuring luminaries from Dell Medical School. Check out episode 49, Building a Model Healthy City, to hear a discussion with Dr. Clay Johnston, Dell Medical School's director, and Dr. Octavio N. Martinez Jr., the HOG Foundation's executive director. It's a conversation about how communities promote mental health and well-being that focuses on Austin, but draws out key insights that have implications for all communities in Texas and beyond. Thanks for joining us.